Hello, and welcome to Locked Up Living, the podcast which looks at resilience in challenging organisations, such as, but not only, prisons and hospitals for mentally ill prisoners and patients. My name is David Jones, and together with Naomi Murphy, I present your Locked Up Living podcast.
Hi, I'm Naomi Murphy, co-host with David Jones of Locked Up Living, a podcast where we explore adversity, survival and growth in austere environments. Today we welcome along our guest, Michaela Booth. Michaela is a criminology graduate, now studying for an MA, and is also award-winning patient engagement lead for Health Injustice, and is also involved with a programme to develop leadership in those with lived experience of the criminal justice system. Welcome.
Hi, Naomi and David. Thanks for having me.
Hi.
Now, Michaela, we're really interested in growth and barriers to growth in the criminal justice system. And from the outside, you look like someone who's really flourished since leaving custody. You've achieved a first in your undergraduate degree. You're now studying for an MA. You've won an award for your work as patient engagement lead. Are you a poster girl for how effective the criminal justice system is at helping people make positive changes in their lives? Or does your lived experience give you a much more nuanced relationship to the criminal justice system?
That's a brilliant question to start with. And I think there's a few different answers. So I'll try and keep this brief given time constraints, because it's something that I could talk about all day. But I think the kind of recognition that I could be seen as a poster girl for the effectiveness of a criminal justice and a punishment system is probably a really easy assumption to make. And from my perspective, I always say that everything that I've achieved so far has been in spite of a system which I find harmful, a system which I find oppressive, and a system which really perpetuates exclusion for people with convictions in society, in the workplace, travel restrictions, access to education. So all of these things are barriers which have personally affected me. All of them are barriers which I've been in a position to overcome with dedicated support from individuals within the system. But that doesn't mean that the system works. That means that there are individuals that work within a system that are willing to, I want to say take risks, but I don't think that take risks is the right term, although that's how people perceive it. So the individuals that have supported me are people, and I've got three people that come to mind. Two of them are my line managers at work, and one of them is the lecturer that gave me a place at university when I did my undergraduate degree. And I met these people personally on a one-to-one basis prior to being accepted into university, prior to being offered a job. So these were people that took time to listen to my personal circumstances, the personal issues that I had that led to my criminalization and imprisonment, the life and the trauma that I'd had prior to that, and what they saw in a person wasn't a conviction and it wasn't trauma. It was a potential. It was the potential to be a person that could contribute to society. And it was a recognition that individuals within systems are the people that really make changes. They make systems change. Systems don't just change. And systems take a lot of time to come round to change. And I think what's become evident to me is these things happen in very small steps, and sometimes they need a lot of influence to these big changes. They come in drips and drabs. So I think in terms of going to university, I never really thought leaving school at the age of 15 and being expelled that I would ever be able to go on to graduate with a first class degree and go and do a master's. I mean, obviously that was the dream for me, and I definitely put the work in to achieve those grades. But I didn't think that I could do that. I mean, it's not something which I ever really thought of. I just wanted to go to university. At the point where I went to university, it was simply just to fill the time because I wasn't happy in my old job. So to come out of that with a first class degree in criminology as somebody that went to prison, I think that looks like a poster girl for someone that rehabilitation worked for. Does a kind of medical term of rehabilitation fit within a punishment system? I don't think it does. So absolutely, I'm not a poster girl for rehabilitation because I don't believe that the concept of rehabilitation fits within a system that punishes and perpetuates exclusion, which then leads to systemic violence. So how can a system that perpetuates harm be a system that also rehabilitates a person back to a state of being good, essentially? So I think being a poster girl is probably something which I don't see the kind of promotion of my achievements as being a poster girl. And if ever anyone has ever said anything like that to me, I have always challenged it. But just going back to kind of the concept of influence and doing these things in drips and drabs, I also think that it's really important that people like me who get to these positions really get a chance to explain how they got there and what was the process and the mechanisms of getting there, if it was in spite of a system, because this is lived experience leadership, where we begin to influence systems change and we do it in small bits. So to see that a woman who has been to prison, a teenage mom, a girl that lived in a council estate that had drug addicts as parents, can graduate and work in the system with a first class degree and be an award-winning patient engagement lead, I think the definitely stories that need to be told and need to be heard. But platforming them as a poster for a successful system is definitely not the way. So I think that's a very long-winded answer. So just to cut that simply down, I don't think that I'm a poster girl. I wouldn't want to be a poster girl. But I think that how I got here is a very, very important story for people to hear who work in the system and the criminal justice and social sector as a whole, because when people who work in the system can take some personal responsibility in their professional role to really activate the values of inclusion, diversity, and equality, that is where we see real change that impacts on the people that use the services that we as a society provide. And if all we're going to do is get people through services and out the other side and not bring these people back in to lead the services where, I don't know percents of certain services, but it's clear to see from the state of the prison system, from the state of the social sector, that services are failing a lot of people, services don't work, and the driving force of any social change has been directly from the people that are disadvantaged by those systems. And we see that in the Black Lives Matter movement, we see that in women's rights, we see that in the LGBT movement, that it is the people who face these oppressions and these discriminations that collectively come together to drive systems change. And we need allies in this space who can see that potential, who can recognize the individuals that can do that, and they need to support and put them in the positions where they can affect that change and work with them and listen to them and support them. So I was supported through university with a scholarship from the Longford Trust, who are an organisation that support former prisoners to access higher education. I was supported through work when I gained my job and was studying, that they would give me a part-time role to get to grips with the role, develop the role, and then a promise that I could come on board full-time as soon as my studies were finished. And that point actually came during COVID, with a lot of staff being furloughed. I was generally quite worried that I was just about to graduate and leave uni and there might not be the role that I thought I was going to go into, but my work took me on full time the day I left uni, and they really give me the autonomy to deliver and develop and implement this role how best I see fit. So I'm not governed by specific rules and regulations where I'm in a position as a lived experience leader, but really I'm being governed by the organisation who are dictating how this leadership happens. And I think that's a separate issue with things that happen across the sector, especially within criminal justice organisations. But that isn't effective lived experience leadership. And I think that the delivery of that model is what hinders the effectiveness of the true value of lived experience leadership across the sector.
We hope to come to that. But I think what was really striking about your answer there was how much of that was hinged on people spotting your potential, and yet the system seems much more weighted in favour of looking for deficits, doesn't it? So looking for the needs that individuals have rather than looking at what could be of value and nourishing what's of value in the person.
I really love reading your dissertation, and found it kind of hooked into me in several ways that were quite personal. One was the whole business of doing that kind of detailed research that you'd done. But a second reason was a rather oddly personal one, in that I'd just recently been reading a paper which was mainly about the East End of London, and my grandmother was born in the East End in an area called Bluegate Fields, which in the mid-19th century was a notorious slum. So when I saw in your opening paragraph this phrase, "In them one sees the most hideous picture of all human weakness," it could have come straight from that paper. You know, it was so striking for me, and so immediately I felt I was getting some sort of idea of what's you meaning. And I wondered if you thought things had really changed very much since then.
It's really interesting that you pull that sentence out from one of the opening paragraphs in that dissertation, and that wasn't an accident for me. That was very much in the introduction of a piece of work that was put together this year, which I knew was going to end on a current depiction of women still in that position. So for listeners that haven't read the dissertation and don't know the context of that quote, that was a depiction of women in prison a few hundred years ago. And more recently, we have the female offender strategy, and a decade ago, maybe the Causton report. And within all of these reports and all of these depictions, which are produced in the name of alleviating these difficulties that women face in prison, they're reports that are based around acknowledging the dire and sheer environments that women in prison live in, that the experiences that they've had of abuse and neglect and all sorts of different things that really have oppressed them throughout their whole lives. And these are documents that the state position as helpful reports to drive change within the system. And I don't know for the listener, but how helpful would it be to drive change if it's a state tactic to label you with stigmatizing and derogatory terminology to enforce their public perception of the need for punishment for women that deviate from social norms of motherhood and femininity. And for people that don't know any better, we would think that all of these drug addict monsters who don't look after their kids need to be punished for the crimes that they commit, and the public perception and comment around these issues, which they comment on from positions of naivety, is, well, you weren't thinking about your kids when you did that. Are the state thinking about our starving kids when they're not funding free school meals? Do we think that the state perpetuate this poverty and this exclusion and all of these issues what face criminalised women that really enforce the state criminalising them and sending them to prison in the first place? We don't really. I mean, and that's the core of what this debate really needs to be around, is when we're producing these reports and we're commissioning these reviews of women in prison and their conditions and making recommendations for improvement, if these reports are just depicting the same sorry state of the prisons that have been reported on year after year after year for hundreds of years, and the depictions of women in prison still don't change, at what point do we start saying, actually, that system isn't fit for purpose? And how are women still in these states hundreds of years later? Because that's a state responsibility to make sure that thousands of women who go to prison shouldn't actually be there in the first place. And it's about recognizing that we need to move this discourse away from individual culpability for offending and realize that the state criminalized women and men for poverty, which is the state responsibility to move away from. But for as long as we can blame people individually for their circumstances, that's as long as we'll get away with punishment, and that punishment will be legitimized through public discourse and through state reports which continue to depict these women as mad, bad or sad. So for me, I take a responsibility within my working professional role and my role as someone with lived experience leading this debate in the sector to really move away from individual culpability. And that isn't to deflect accountability or responsibility from individuals that have committed offences. But if the role of prisons and punishment has produced the same depictions and the same outcomes for women, surely we must realise that that isn't working. And for as long as we continue to use that mechanism to deal with these things, the longer these systems and services aren't going to work, because they're tackling individual blame and culpability to move individuals away from positions of needing to offend or offending through circumstance and environment. And we're not tackling the root causes of offending. And we're actually not recognising the state's role in criminalisation, in oppression, and the state through its use of language. We accept that because most of the people that read those reports don't feel the impact of those discriminatory terms, and they're not excluded because they've been written about in a certain way for hundreds of years, but I am. And the women in prison that I was in prison with, they are. So I really feel the consequences of that. And I think there's a difference between knowing something isn't right and feeling the consequences of something not being right. And that's really where I drive my attention to, is when I feel the consequences of that, or the people that I work to deliver services to feel the consequences of that.
That's brilliant answer, actually. But if we just move on now, I wonder if, because we all have agreed that we loved your dissertation, we think it really rings true. That's what we were both struck by. But I wonder if you can tell us a little bit about it. What got you into that field? How did you start to do the research? And what were the outcomes?
So my dissertation, it was something that I went into university with the idea of doing. So I knew really throughout the 3 years that my dissertation would focus on the value of lived experience within the criminal justice sector. Then it was a case of getting it from a broad concept into something that which I could do at an undergraduate level within the constraints of all of that. So it was a specific focus on women's experiences of lived experience leadership within the criminal justice sector. So the literature review was really based around the conversation that we just had about the state's impact on really the effectiveness of these roles and how the depictions of women in prison really impact on our ability to move away from that stigma and that political discourse of offenders, which the state still use in their reports while they're advertising that criminal justice sector organisations should actually recruit offenders, which I just find astonishing. So the focus was on women. My research participants were all women that had been in prison, and they were all women that were now working in a leadership role within the criminal justice sector. So there was private and voluntary organisations within the research. And I went into that research really thinking that I knew what the outcomes were going to be, and I knew from my personal experience the value of lived experience leadership across the criminal justice sector. And I thought that the research would really mirror my own experiences. And two of the research participants were colleagues that I work with in different organisations. So I really know them on a friendship level as well. They self-recruited to be a part of my study. And then I needed to find a third participant. And I put a notice up on Twitter to say that the theme of my dissertation and what I was researching as a call for participants. And through that, I was directed to a number of people. And one of the research participants was identified to me by their employer as a woman who fitted my research criteria. So a woman that had experienced imprisonment and was now working in a leadership role within the criminal justice sector.
That really stood out from your dissertation, actually, because I think there's a sense of almost familiarity. There's that if you're not directly employed by the prison service, you do kind of get the message that you don't belong, even as somebody who doesn't have lived experience. So can only begin to imagine how hard that is when you do have in terms of the stigma and the messages that you get.
Yeah.
Another point that really resonated was, you know, which comes on from that really, was the importance of choosing individuals for leadership positions who do have the knowledge and experience and skills to really make a difference. And you see this also in mental health, that too often the people are chosen for that role that requires lived experience only because they have lived experience. And perhaps because they raise it in ways that are non-threatening to the power structures rather than because their lived experience is a bonus to enhance their skills and knowledge. And I wondered whether you had any thoughts on why that was.
Yeah, I think it's definitely very prominent within the criminal justice sector. And I think that it's important to say before I go on to discuss lived experience leadership roles, that the voices and experiences of people are very important, and that everybody who wants to have a say and have their experiences listened to deserves a place to be heard. So that is something which really drives the work of lived experience leaders across the sector, and that was prominent in the research study for the two self-identified leaders in their work to create systemic change. with a recognition of a whole cohort of voiceless people, because the mechanics of organizations sustain the voicelessness, not because people don't or can't share their stories, that there are mechanisms in place which prevent this from happening. So I think that the role of the voices of people with lived experience is very important. But I think what really came through on that research study was having the knowledge and the skill and the ability and the power to influence systemic change. Now you've read the dissertation, so you'll see that the two self-identified leaders within the study, they spoke about their ambitions for system-wide change across sectors. It wasn't limited to organizational change. It was kind of limitless in terms of their ambition, and their achievements to date were also highly systemic in terms of what they've managed to do across systems so far. And what was also clear is none of that happened by accident. They worked through various different roles across the sector with the intention of gaining these positions of leadership to affect this systemic change. This wasn't something that happened. It progressed through experience and through expanding knowledge and opportunities that came in roles prior to their leadership roles, but it was always their ambition, and they envisioned what systemic change looked like from the inside and from their positions within organizations. So it isn't effective, and it's not efficient to suggest that lived experience is the catalyst for leadership and systems change, because it isn't. And we see that at various different conferences where people don't have the skills or the knowledge to recognize oppression or exploitation, even when it's happening, and even when it's happening to them. And that's the target audience and the target kind of receptance for this work, because it's easier to have those people positioned as the lived experience voices and leaders, because they're helpful in propping up a system that doesn't work, because they're unable to articulate or see the places where it doesn't work. And for big organizations that are utilizing lived experience to actually have a challenging voice and say, this doesn't work and this is why, the systems change that is needed from that, and to know that these people are going to be the voice to hold you to account to make those changes, it's very difficult. And that's not to say that there aren't people within HMPPS, within the Ministry of Justice, within the House Service that don't recognise and utilise this. And I mean, my participants within various big organisations are testament to people actually do value and do put people in places who can and do lead the systemic change. But they're very few and far between. And that's not an accident. We're not accidentally putting people in positions of leadership knowing that true leadership isn't going to happen. We're not doing that by accident. It's intentional, because this work is very demanding. And if you have that challenging voice, not only the challenging voice, but someone that's going to hold you to account for doing this work, it's easy to say that you want it. It's easy to say that it's good and valued. It's not easy to put those people in places to then drive that work forward. And you're going to have to pay those people within those roles to drive that work forward. And for a lot of people, putting their money where their mouth is isn't something that they want to do. And it's very few and far between. So I think that the recognition is right that there are people with lived experience who are being exploited in these roles. And that's really, really harmful to the lived experience leadership movement. And it's really harmful on an individual level, because we position these people and organizations position them in positions which which they can't fulfill to any kind of true systems change effect. And as a leader within the sector and the lived experience movement and all of my colleagues, we're not prepared to come down to that level to meet these organisations of positions of tokenistic engagement and consultation. We absolutely know that in terms of this lived experience movement, that we are the change makers here, and we have the knowledge and the skills and the power to drive it forward. And we're not prepared to come down to a level of tokenistic tick box consultation for £20 love to shop vouchers and to be named as a lived experience credit on a report, when we're going to be writing these reports and we're going to be affecting this change from our positions using our hard earned knowledge from our lived experience. And I think that's really important to recognize. And there are definitely movements within the sector and within organizations that are really embracing that leadership. But there are certainly some organisations that are really falling below what is acceptable, and it's exploitation.
Yeah, and it's very troubling to hear that. And I suppose it also, it does remind me of the work that I think ought to be done by psychological services, in terms of, I think one of your participants described themselves as saying that they should be an irritant in their role. And personally, I think that's what psychologists, mental health practitioners working within the prison system should be. I think if the prison service is to grow and change beyond what it has been, they need outsiders, all those with lived experience, to be invited to participate as irritants. And there should be an acceptance and recognition that this is really valuable. And yet it's very difficult, you know, just listening to you describe your participants as people who are very creative, adaptive, robust and visionary. And it's quite a special combination of individuals, that of characteristics that can make those individual voices resonate and be heard. I wondered whether you have any ideas on how to help the criminal justice sector see that they need those irritants.
I think they know that they need them. And I think that where this lived experience work is done wrong is through the tokenistic methods of kind of consultation, no accountability and exploitative engagement opportunities. So through that, the organisations are already recognising the value of lived experience, because they kind of promote that work within the sector and that they do it. So I don't think that it's an absence of having to influence the sector to realise that it's valuable. I think what's needed is a recognition of the value of people and what it means to come and work in these roles. And I mean, when we're talking about lived experience leadership, even within my participants with the self-identified leaders, they weren't talking from positions of past experience. Their lives are still very much related to oppression, whether that be through family members, whether that be through having mixed race children, and their experiences are still experiences of members of society who face discrimination and exclusion. And for people that work in these lived experience leadership roles, we don't finish work at 5:30 and turn the laptop off, because all of the things that we talk about, that we share our knowledge of, that we begin to teach, they're very much things that still impact our lives on a daily basis. So we don't finish work and go home and turn it off, because we can't, because that is our life. And those lived experiences don't change just because we get jobs and we've got a little bit of recognition and a little bit of power within the sector. That doesn't change our life experiences and our lived experiences. And I think that's what the sector needs to realise when we're trying to influence systemic change, and we understand and say that we recognise the value of lived experience and lived experience leadership within this movement, that there's a perception that consultations with lived experience panels is enough to drive that change. And these things have been happening for years, and these organizations that use these panels, they write reports and don't name the people that have contributed to this production of knowledge. And what happens when you don't name them, when you look at this through great critique, that's another means of keeping someone voiceless. And if using lived experience and utilizing that in leadership or consultation, in a recognition that so many people within the system are voiceless and powerless, if we then use these panels and do exactly the same thing which our oppressors are doing to us, which we're trying to move away from, you're just as bad and you're inflicting just the same pain than the system that you say you're working against in kind of allyship to our emancipation, because that's not happening when you keep lived experience people voiceless in lived experience work. And this comes back to the need for attribution and organizations to be positioned as people that utilize lived experience. It's all well and good doing 10 panels a year all around the country with people with lived experience and writing all these reports, because organizationally that gets you clout, that gets you power, that gets you funding to be able to do this. But I wonder how many of those participants who go and enter those lived experience panels really feel the benefits of moving away from those experiences that they share with the researchers in attempts to alleviate the peers from those same experiences. And actually, if we're not using lived experience to develop and enhance our services to make sure that the experiences of those that are oppressed and discriminated against don't happen or happen less frequently, and that's not even happening to our own participants, then we're not doing a good enough job. And I think, how patronizing is it for someone that is on benefits, that struggles to pay their bills, their rent, and get shopping for the month, that they go and do a lived experience consultancy with an organization who is producing reports to the sector in an attempt to influence them to employ people with lived experience, because they know that employment is something that leads people away from offending and prison, but they're not doing that themselves. And they're giving, instead of job roles, which they're promoting across the sector, £25 love to shop vouchers in exchange for this knowledge and experience. And this happens all the time. And I just wonder, as someone who's leading this debate in the sector, who only went to university 3 years ago, how I'm here and recognizing all of this stuff just through a short period of time and facing all of those barriers with the lived experience movement and the colleagues that I work with, how we're here in 2020 and this stuff is only just on the agenda, because this can't be things that haven't been noticed. And this can't be something that organisations don't know they're doing. And I just find it very, very inauthentic for any service, any organisation to be producing reports to influence the sector to employ people with lived experience if all they're doing is keeping participants voiceless and keeping them in positions of poverty, of inequality, and not doing anything to drive these people away from those experiences.
I think, and where you almost answered your own question, yeah, there, because sometimes some of these things have been noticed and have been said, but there are power structures which don't want to act on them. And that's the... That's the intrinsic problem. How does one get things to change, to shift? That's been one of the big drivers that set Naomi and I off on this track of the podcast, really, to try and find ways to influence in the same way that you're influencing people, to influence towards change. But if I can move on, because I think we were both really struck by the attention that you paid to language and how language might reinforce systemic and socially inflicted damage. So that was a very kind of prominent part of your dissertation. And we've also noticed in the past that you've written about trauma tourism, and you know, wondered if you'd like to say something about that.
Yeah, I think for me, language is really, really important. And I think when I briefly spoke to Naomi about coming to do this podcast, I shared a story about my own kind of position on language and my past experiences of using oppressive language myself at points in time where I didn't have the knowledge to understand the impact of those words. And I certainly came into this sector, came onto social media and positioned myself within this sector as an ex-prisoner. And I don't do that anymore. I mean, I'm happy to say that I'm a former prisoner when I feel that the time is right or it's appropriate to the conversation. But I think the use of language across the sector is so dominant and it's so enforced that I know that it's really hard to move away from. But I also know that once you take the time to understand the effects of that language, it's very easy to change, because you'll notice from my dissertation that I always use the words criminalized women or former prisoners. There's no female offender in there unless it's quoted from a state report or another organization's report that uses stigmatizing language. Recently, I can't remember what organization it was, but there was a report from an organization that works in substance misuse and recovery, and they produced a glossary of terms, and it was so fabulous for me to read it, because it literally documented stigmatizing terms. It provided a summary of why they weren't going to use those terms, in recognition that some of their service users may even identify with those stigmatizing terms. And it gave the term what they'd use instead. And in the production of this, it proves that the organization understands, even if the individuals within the service don't, the impact of stigma and discrimination through the use of language. And it's easy to say that this is the dominant discourse, but it's hard to examine that the effects of that dominant discourse and stop using it. And I'm not sure if it's in this dissertation, but it's certainly in a blog I've written about the definition of violence, and how the use of stigmatizing language is a form of state-inflicted systemic violence which perpetuates harm on certain groups. And it's mostly invisible, because you can see the words, but feeling the impact, you don't see them. And Imogen Tyler's work as Stigma as the Machinery of Inequality was a really influential piece for directing my dissertation and my research around language. And there's a really good book around tattooing, and it's called Written on the Body, and that's around the impact of stigma and how we used to tattoo crimes on people that had been convicted of offending, and that would be their personal reminder that they're forever not the same as other people in society, and that would be the marker for society to treat them differently. And that was a visible scar that perpetuated stigma as a tattoo. And now we don't use tattoos, so the stigma perpetuated by our language is invisible. It's a form of invisible violence. And those terms that we use to label are simply invisible tattoos, which give people the legitimacy to treat those with stigmatizing labels differently. But just because it's invisible, it doesn't mean that it's not important to pay attention to it. And because I'll talk about this, and there'll be so much debate, even with people that have those labels attached to them, whether they accept them or they reject them. And you'll hear the conversations around, well, I don't mind being called that, and someone else does. I think that every single organisation should do a review of the language that they use in their reports, in their conversations, and I think really reflect on the impact of that language on discrimination, on the impact of stigma. And I think every organisation that works with oppressed and marginalised groups needs to produce their own glossary and really evidence why they feel a need to move away from stigmatising language. And I think for the sector, that would be a brilliant way forward.
That's a great suggestion. And instead, I suppose what comes to mind is there's your observation in your dissertation again, that the MOJ, which is tasked with rehabilitation, obviously, continues to use stigmatising language. And I wonder, you know, whether that represents a kind of conflict between the aspirations of those at the MOJ and kind of like deeper attitudes and feelings. You know, you spoke earlier about knowing something intellectually, but actually feeling something differently. And I wonder if that's there in the ether around the MOJ.
Well, I remember specifically the paragraph around that, and that was a summary of the education and training strategy from the Ministry of Justice. I forgot the date of it, but I remember a specific sentence which may be quoted in that dissertation, and the MOJ in that report state, "We understand the recognition of stigma and discrimination through the use of ex-offender labels or offender labels," and in the next paragraph they seek to influence organizations to employ offenders or ex-offenders because it supports desistance. I really don't know how anyone can read that and put any faith or value on a report that in one sentence suggests that employing individuals who have criminal records is valuable to rehabilitation and social value. It should be a social responsibility to do that if we want to limit the amount of victims in society. So that's important to state first. But for a state report to recognise the impact of stigmatising labels on employment, to write a whole report using those stigmatising labels is just beyond me. And that is the point of proof that these labels are not perpetuated by the state through ignorance or through naivety. It's a purposeful tactic to ensure that people with convictions are excluded from the labour market. You absolutely cannot recognise the impact of stigmatising labels on access to the job market while you're perpetuating those same labels in your same report, which is a call to help those people. You absolutely cannot do that. And actually, it should be the responsibility of every single organisation that has a stake in education and training within that Ministry of Justice strategy to be calling that out for absolute hypocrisy. And if they understand the consequences of stigma and labels, to absolutely stop using them in every single report that they write, because they are perpetuating that stigma through their own use of language, which they recognise as harmful.
I would imagine that for the three people in your study, it must have been much, much harder. They must have encountered many more kind of obstacles. How far do you think those obstacles would have undermined the kind of work that they could do?
Definitely throughout my research and with my participants, there were instances where the system and the mechanisms of the system have really undermined their position and really impacted them on their abilities to do their job. And I think the reason for why this happens. And I completely get your own experiences and definitely kind of from colleagues who I speak to who work in various different roles within a prison. It's definitely a shared experience with anyone who isn't a kind of prison officer. But I think that that's where we need a recognition that although we have various different services within a prison, and we suggest that prisons take a rehabilitative culture, and that this is embedded within prison service delivery, we know from experience that whether it be healthcare, whether it be education, whether it be a specific program that trains and educates or employs women in prison, that all of these services are delivered within the restraints and restrictions of a system of punishment. So when we're denying people access to education, or we're denying people access to healthcare, or we're denying people access to psychological interventions or programs that they need to do to progress for parole and things like that, that isn't in line with a rehabilitative culture. That's a system of punishment. So I think that all of these various issues which we seem to kind of identify in terms of how this affects us personally in line with our roles and responsibilities, we're missing a trick here by seeing how these impact and should affect the policies and strategies that govern the prison system in the first place. So if prisoners aren't being given access to education or healthcare or interventions because, for example, there's not enough staff, that's a policy and practice and recruitment and retention issue for the government. And that issue denies the people in prison with the rehabilitative culture which the government claim that happens within a prison. So I think that whilst recognizing all of these individual issues and experiences are important across the board in every single organization, I think what we miss, which would actually lead to more changes, recognizing these within the context of policy and strategy and systemic change. I mean, if we're reading HMIP reports and IMB reports about prisoners and the states that they're living in and how much they're locked in a day and the issues with education and everything like that, their access to whatever programs people deem fit for them, and we know that access is really bad, should we be calling the culture within that prison a rehabilitative culture, or do we just say that because we think that it sounds good? And it should be the people that work within that culture to actually say that it's not, that we're not actually doing what it says on the tin, but they won't, because they are happy to go to work and draw a salary to go home and pay their mortgage. And this is what I say about understanding something is wrong and feeling that something is wrong, because all of those people in prison that don't get their access to healthcare, that don't get their access to education, that are denied places on courses due to staff not being there or whatever the issue is, COVID at the moment. I was thinking the other day, the backlog of people that are not going to get parole and not going to get released because of the impact of COVID. And is it right that we can keep people in prison because we can't deliver the services which we should be delivering? And I don't think it is, but when people are working in those kind of environments with so much trauma and so much violence that they see, and it must be a really difficult job. And I think then where I think that the challenge and the recognition needs to come from with inside the prison, I completely understand that just looking after people in prison on a daily basis on a wing is probably all that people have enough energy for. So to challenge the system and say that we're not doing what the government says we should be doing, it is probably out of the realms of their remit and their responsibility in terms of their role. But I think it's everybody's responsibility to pay attention to what's happening in prisons. If we as a society use prison to punish members of society who will come out and be members of society, I think everybody needs to take a responsibility to understand and improve the conditions of prisons. And if we don't do that, it's never going to change. And for as much as prison officers have a very difficult job to do, and we know from research, from articles, from hearing from prison officers that their job is very hard and they want things to change. So we need to take accountability and responsibility to drive that change. And it's never going to come just from doing the day's work at the, not the bare minimum, but no direct kind of drive for systemic change. And I mean, I've seen some reports from the Prison Officer Association saying that kind of drug use violence has decreased in a twisted effort to suggest that 23-hour lockup should be the norm to address these issues. And if you think that's a position that could actually have the power to drive change in prisons, that's really, really scary. So other voices are definitely needed and welcome within this debate of systemic change and improvement. And
it sounds as if you think that even the number one governor isn't able to make significant change, that it's a much more systemic issue than that.
Yeah, I definitely think that the powers above governors are what enforce and drive punishment within the prison system. And I think that the change that's needed is currently far beyond the realms of individual governors. And that's not to say that within their individual prisons and their individual roles that they're not making great efforts to create change, because they absolutely are. There's some fantastic initiatives that go on in prison to help support rehabilitation. But I think it all comes back to the political and state production of how we view criminalized people and to what extent that legitimizes the Sun and the Daily Mail's depiction of prisoners and how much we think that they deserve to be punished and are individually accountable and culpable for offending. And that's what drives our need for punishment as a society, and it's certainly what we get. And like I said before, the people that legitimize this and vote for this party that leads our country, they speak about prisons and about punishment and about prisoners from positions of only hearing the political discourse through these tabloid newspapers and political speeches, where we're calling people offenders. And people do offend. It's not to say that people don't offend, but the perpetuation of this dominant language and the stigma that we use to keep this mechanism of inequality in place, it's intentional from the state. The state don't do this by accident. And that is what drives the prison system. So until that changes, the changes that can be made within the prison service and the courts and punishment in general, it isn't really going to impact on the amount of people that are criminalized and punished and sent to prison in the first place. And I think the political context of prison and punishment is something that people don't think about or try and address too much, that the focus is always on rehabilitative programs or that really target individuals and see them as individually culpable or deficit in some way, and we target their deficits to make them better people, as opposed to targeting a government or a political structure which legitimizes that punishment in the first place, as opposed to tackling the systemic drivers of criminalization, oppression, and marginalization. And that's where the discourse and the attention needs to go for any change to filter down into courts, prisons, and punishment in general.
You've got some really thought-provoking points to make, Michaela, and it's been a brilliant discussion. It feels like actually we could easily talk for a lot longer, but I'm conscious of how generous you've been with your time already, and I just wanted to give you the chance to give a bit of a plug really to the programme that you've been involved with about developing leadership potential. I wondered if you would like the opportunity to say something about that.
Yeah, so I've been working with a team of lived experience leaders who are working in and across the criminal justice and social sector in collaboration with CLAW Social Leadership and the Centre for Knowledge Equity in putting together a leadership programme for people in lived experience roles across the criminal justice sector. We recently promoted this to take applications. We had 100 free spaces for people to come on a six-month leadership program. The deadline for applications has gone, and we exceeded over the number of applicants that we needed to fill all of the spaces. So in terms of kind of promotion and application, we now know that there are hundreds of people across the sector that are doing this lived experience work that want to move into leadership and really need the support to do it. And if we're thinking from a position of critique here, how have we got over 100 people working in the sector in lived experience roles without their employers providing or funding or paying for these leadership training opportunities? But like I said before, it's the drive of the people who face these issues that are really going to drive this change. And that's certainly what we've seen with this lived experience leadership movement and the people that I've been working with to create this programme, to recruit and drive this programme forward. So the programme's going to begin in January for a period of 6 months for aspiring criminal justice and social sector lived experience leaders. So we'll review the success of that and write a report and hopefully get some funding to be able to deliver this again to people who are aspiring to lead change across the sector but need some support. And I think I would encourage organisations that are employing people with lived experience to recognize them for more than people with convictions and to dedicate resource and dedicate training, leadership training to these people, because based in this sector, although I've talked a lot about diversity, equality and inclusion, we know the demographics of people in prison and their histories with drug abuse, with education, the amount of services that have already failed them before they get to prison. And actually, the equality policies that we have within organisations are great for protecting people that don't have those experiences, but we need more than equality. And we actually need equity, which is a recognition that we don't have the same opportunities and choices, and we actually need more to get there. So we need more help, we need more funding, and we need more opportunities to get to a place of equality. But that has to drive from a position of recognizing inequity. I mean, I go to work and I'm definitely viewed as equal to my colleagues, but in terms of social standing and human capital, are we equitable? No, we're not. We're not. And that needs to be the driving force of organisations that are utilising and also wanting to promote lived experience leadership. Is the policies that are in place at the moment are great for supporting people that haven't been impacted by inequality for most or if not all of their lives. And equity is what we need, and inequity is what we need recognised, and the redress between that needs addressing and action, not just kind of thought and promises and dedication. It needs action.
Thank you, Michaela. I mean, that's been such a brilliant conversation. Loads and loads of food for thought. And also, I think, given me lots of ideas about people to elaborate on some of those themes as well. So it's been brilliant. Thank you very, very much.
Lovely to meet you.
Thank you. Bye.
Well, that was a terrific interview with Michaela. She's got so much energy. And what I took away from it, well, she clearly doesn't want to be seen as a poster girl for transformation that occurs in prison, because, as she says, there are so many obstacles put up to any kind of learning and development in the prison setting. But she does remember that she got help from particular individuals, and she clearly welcomed that.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that element of the interview. I mean, I really liked Michaela's passion for the subject and trying to contribute something that's going to make people's lives better. But I also found that really interesting, that point about how important it is to have someone really believe in you, someone see you as a person, and how life-changing that can be.
Many thanks again to all of you who have listened to our Locked Up Living podcast. Feel free to mention this to your friends and to your colleagues, and give us feedback on our webpage, lockeduplives.com, and our Twitter account, Locked Up Living. Many thanks too to Pete and Rach, who kindly allowed us to use their music, You Have Called Me Courage, and this is available from all the usual outlets.